For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and today we'll explore Art is Everywhere, the ultimate guide to awesome art in the world around us and the great people making it, with author Joe Haddell. We'll also find some new books entering the RNIB Talking Books Library. All that to come on today's Read On. Art is Everywhere is the ultimate guide to awesome art in the world around us and the great people making it. Joe Haddell is the author of this inspiring, friendly guide to art and why it matters. You can meet the incredible people making art of all kinds and follow the tips to make your own. If you're listening to this show on the day of release, this book came out in print yesterday, and at the time of recording, it's exclusively available in audio only from RNIB Talking Books. It's read by the author himself.
What is art? That's a big question. Probably too big to start with, actually. Let's try this instead. What do you think art is? I used to think art referred to drawings and paintings and nothing else. Art was something that hung on the walls of galleries and museums, I thought. Well, some art does hang on the walls of galleries and museums, and drawings and paintings are certainly art. But that little word, those three letters, A-R-T, cover so much more than just drawings and paintings. Now when I think of art, I think of music, books, films, dance, poetry, comedy, fashion, photography, TV, and so many other things. Art is everywhere.
Joe Haddell reading from his book Art is Everywhere. He joined me down the line and first told me a bit about his background.
I started working for the BBC in about 2007, I think it was. I was still studying. I was in the last year of university and always knew I wanted to work in radio, always knew it, and managed to land myself a job at the BBC at Radio 2, and I was making tea, pretty good at making tea. And I was answering phones and worked my way up to becoming a producer there. And I had 14 very happy years at the BBC between Radio 2 and 6 Music and 5 Live. And that whole time, I was also interested in other forms of art. I've always thought of myself as a bit of a creative, if I'm honest, and making radio shows, as you know, is very much a creative thing. And being a presenter or a producer or building documentaries or whatever it is that you do in that audio space, you know, I've found is a great, great creative space and a passion of mine. But alongside it, I was dabbling in writing. I was drumming quite a lot, learnt drums when I was 9, and have never wanted to do it as a sort of career, really. I didn't want the drums to turn into my job. I just enjoyed doing it. But I've always played them since I was 9. And I was very lucky to go out on tour with a couple of my very talented friends who are, you know, proper musicians. So I feel like I've, you know, I've done that. I've done the rock and roll thing. But I did that alongside, you know, working at the BBC. I took 6 weeks off. I remember asking my boss if I could have 6 weeks unpaid leave. And they said, yes, why? I said, I'm going on tour with the Waterboys. And I was, technically, but we were the support act. But still, I went on tour with the Waterboys for 6 weeks drumming around the UK. And it was absolutely fab. And then more recently, I've been really interested in visual art. I mean, my dad always made art when I was growing up. In fact, my bedroom is now his art studio. He was a head teacher for many, many years, but he studied art and he's always loved painting. And I think I grew up around his art and around the books that him and my mum had around the house. So I've always loved reading, always loved looking at art. I mean, I cannot paint to save my life personally, but yeah, more recently I've started collecting it and filling my walls with all sorts of wonderful things. And now I am a writer because this is my first book. I'm still working at the BBC. I run the Radio 2 Book Club. I also run a production company who makes podcasts and does lots of wonderful things in the audiovisual space. And I'm clinging on to that rock and roll lifestyle as a drummer. Just
Well, you've got the Radio 2 Book Club and your own podcast Book Off. Is it weird being on the other side?
Yes, it is, Robert, because I just feel like I need to ask you lots of questions rather than be answering them. But I think working for the BBC for so long and doing a little bit on air as well, and I remember I co-hosted a show on Radio Berkshire for a while, and then as you say, doing my podcast, doing Book Off, which is in its 11th series now, I think, my goodness, it has helped, I think, being able to do interviews like this. I think it's helped me to know what is required of me, I suppose.
Now, you recorded the audiobook of Art is Everywhere, so before we start talking about it, let's have a listen.
When I first realised this, my mind was blown. I also thought that being an artist meant you had to be able to paint or draw. I thought an artist had a big canvas, a paintbrush, and was probably wearing a beret. How wrong I was about that too. So, I can make music and be called an artist? Yes, Joe. Or I could take up photography and also be called an artist? Yes. This discovery was pretty life-changing for me. Of course, we do call people who paint and draw and screen print and sculpt artists. But there are so many other people who are artists, and I'm going to tell you all about them in this book. I see artists as being sort of part of a big worldwide family, one which I'm very happy and privileged to be a member of, and which, by the end of this book, you may want to join too. Everyone is welcome.
Well, it's a book about the joy of creativity, looking at what it means to just be creative, whether that means you're writing or dancing or singing or acting or, you know, making visual art. It also looks at a lot of art forms that are out there. So I take an art form, maybe that's music, for example, a big passion of mine, and I do a sort of whole chapter on music and look at some of the brilliant artists who are making music who I admire. So each chapter focuses on three people who are, in my opinion, making brilliant art in that sort of genre.
So who are some of the people that feature in the book?
I could have put so many people in this book because I'm constantly in awe of, you know, artists who are making art. And I was going through a long list before I had to knuckle it down. And I was like, this person, this person, this person, this person. In the end, I think what I've done and what I hope I've done is chosen not only brilliant people who are really good at what they do or what they're known for in an artistic sense, but who also have other strings to their bow. So, for example, in the acting section of the book, I have the wonderful Russell Tovey, who I very much admire. And he is a brilliant actor, both stage and screen actor. And that's sort of what he's known for. But he also hosts a podcast called Talk Art. And he is a huge visual art fan, or art in general fan, and a big collector as well. And he's curated quite a lot of exhibitions over the last few years. So I chose him because of that. I chose Questlove, who is a drummer, one of my favourite drummers, who also has directed films. So he's directed an amazing documentary called The Summer of Soul. And he's also co-written a book. Rosie Jones is in it, the fabulous comedian who I absolutely adore and who is just a joy personified. And again, she is known for her comedy, but she has written books as well. So I think in the end, what I did was choose people who had more than just one thing that they were perhaps known for or do, so that I could show that you don't have to do one thing or be known for one thing, and that art actually is very fluid. So if you're a creative you might like drawing, but you also might like writing. Or if you're a drawer, you might like dancing. Or if you like art, you might like acting. So that's how I sort of came to the people that are in it.
Give us a real world example. Say we're out in the street, where could we find art?
Well, Robert, it really is everywhere. And the more I've been talking about this book and through the process of writing it, quite a few people were asking me this question, and I have really thought about it. I was just the other day thinking, well, if you're out and about in the street and you're seeing colours and posters and buses and, you know, these things all have art on them. They all have maybe images, photography, design, paintings that might be on them. But if you're also walking down the street and hearing some music from a shop or a busker on the street, there's some art being created right there in front of you. If you're sitting listening to an audiobook on your way to work, well, someone has written that book that you're listening to. Someone has recorded that book that you're listening to. So the more I started thinking about it as a concept, the more I thought, yeah, I think it's true. I think the title is true. And if you really want to, you can find it anywhere.
Tiny Klaxon alert. There are a few people who disagree with me on the whole everyone is welcome thing. They are called art snobs. And trust me, we don't need to pay any attention to them. A snob is someone who looks down their nose at certain things in a judgy way. I knew a snob at school, a boy in my class, who thought he had great taste in music and always liked to get into arguments about bands and singers. I had listened to an album by a new singer at the time called Pink, and I loved it. When I told him about it, this was his reaction. Pah! And then he made a face like he'd just smelled something really bad. Have you heard Pink's album? I asked. No, I know it's going to be rubbish. Snob alert! The boy in my class judged something without even listening to it, because he assumed it wouldn't be good art. But I had the last laugh there, or rather, Pink did, as she has gone on to sell more than 100 million records worldwide.
So you mentioned audiobooks, and you recorded the audiobook of Art is Everywhere at the RNIB Talking Book Studios. How was that?
I loved it. Absolutely loved it. I was a bit nervous maybe going in to do that. I'd never done anything quite like it, but was so very well looked after by everyone there in Camden. And reading it, actually, I don't know, it really made me think more about it, because obviously when you're writing, you're very in it. You don't often read it out loud to yourself or read it back to yourself. You might change words here and there, and then you get notes from your editor and your publisher and everything, but sat there with it in front of me. And actually the way I did it was to have the book with the full visuals in it so that I could see what was happening on the page. I thought that would help me deliver it a bit better. Hopefully it has. But reading it was a real moment. It was a real joy for me, because I thought, wow, it's an actual book. And it was all right.
Now, you did say you start with the book in front of you, and it is illustrated by Ellie Hose. Unfortunately, we'll miss the illustrations when we download the audiobook, but can you perhaps describe one and the cover?
Yeah, sure. The cover is bright yellow, and it pops with all these lovely little characters that Ellie has drawn doing art. So there's a drummer on there, as I recall, and there's a lovely paintbrush and what do you call the thing that you put the paints on? Palettes, and that's it, yeah. and there's some references to acting, and there's a dancer on there. Inside the book is black and white, so the images are black and white as well. In each chapter, as I mentioned, there's three people that I pick out to talk about. So Ellie has designed little images of them. So each of the people featured in the book have their own illustration. Throughout, there's a lot of words that pop and sentences that pop that were made bigger and bolder by our fabulous designer, Becky. She's done an amazing job of making the design of the book really sort of sing. But one of my favourite illustrations, if I'm allowed to choose myself, is the design that Ellie's done of me walking around an art gallery. And that appears quite early on in the book. And I just think she captured me perfectly. And I love this idea of me, or this image of me just being there, wandering through an art gallery, as I like to do, looking at the walls. So I think that's possibly my favourite.
Now, you have recorded the audio version. So is it important that it's now accessible to people, for whatever reason, have difficulty accessing print?
Yes, so important, I think, so important for all children, because I want this book to encourage children to sort of get creative and to either discover art forms they may not have thought about that they'd like, so listening to music that they perhaps didn't know existed or didn't think they'd like. I put a playlist in the book as well of some suggestions and some of the people that feature in it. Also, I think giving tips. I'm not saying I'm an expert, but I hope that some of the tips that I've put in there to help encourage the readers to maybe try it for themselves, whether that be singing or dancing or whatever it is, I hope will sort of encourage a new generation of artists, really.
You've sort of already answered this question, but what would you want people to take away from the book?
I think one of the key messages in it, and I hope that comes across, is that art is everywhere, but also for everyone. And one of the messages I'm trying to tell kids is that you can do art and be an artist and have it as a career if you want. Don't let anyone tell you that you can't do the thing you love and follow your passion and be that as a job. But equally, you don't have to do that. And art can live alongside other things. It can be for fun. It can be for relaxation. It can be good for your mental health. And so I think, and I hope, that the book is sort of saying that you can do art in whatever guise you wish, with your friends, at home with your family, or you can do it to pursue as something you want to do later in life. Now, before we really get going, I know you'll have some questions. So I've tried to guess a few that I think you'll want to know. What can I expect from this book then, Joe? Well, we're going to look at some creative people I think you'll enjoy finding more out about, if you don't know them already. And I'm going to give you tips on how you can find your inner artist, whether that's putting pen to paper to create your first story, learning a few jokes to recite to your friends and family, or getting your dancing shoes on and gearing you up for your best twirl. I actually know a bit about art. In fact, I already know I want to be an artist. So, should I read on? Brilliant. And yes, you should, because one of the great things about being an artist is appreciating fellow artists' work and learning from it. If I don't know anything about art, is there anything in this book for me? Oh, absolutely. We're going on a journey of discovery together. So let's get on with it, shall we?
A final clip of Joe Haddell reading from Art Is Everywhere. If you're listening to this show on the day it was released, the book came out yesterday. It's available in print commercially and only available in audio at the time of recording from RNIB Talking Books. And Joe Haddell, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much, Robert. It's been great speaking to you.
And Joe will be back at the end of the show for the books of his life.
If you have a question about living with sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is here to offer support. Whether it's connecting to your Wi-Fi or connecting to your community. From remote banking to TV remotes. Call us on 0303 123 9999 or say, Alexa, call RNIB helpline for more information. RNIB, see differently.
And now it's time to join Lynn Livingston once again for a roundup of some new books in the RNIB Talking Books Library.
First up this week, we have the timely new work by award-winning Ukrainian writer Andrei Kirkov. Grey Bees was donated to us by Maglihos Press from the Hachette Group.
Sergei Sergeyevich was roused by the cold air at about 3 a.m. The potbelly stove he had cobbled together in imitation of a picture in Cozy Cottage magazine, with its little glass door and 2 burners, had ceased to give off any warmth. The 2 tin buckets that stood by its side were empty. He lowered his hand into the nearest of them, and his fingers found only coal dust. "All right," he groaned sleepily, put on his trousers, slid his feet into the slippers he had fashioned out of an old pair of felt boots, pulled on his sheepskin coat, took both buckets, and went into the yard. He stopped behind the shed in front of a pile of coal, and his eyes landed on the shovel. It was much brighter out here than inside. Lumps of coal poured down, thumping against the bottoms of the buckets. Soon the echoing thumps died away, and the rest of the lumps fell in silence. Somewhere far off, a cannon sounded. Half a minute later, there was another blast, which seemed to come from the opposite direction.
Little Starodivka, a village of 3 streets, lies in Ukrainians' grey zone, the no man's land between loyalist and separatist forces. Thanks to the lukewarm war of sporadic violence and constant propaganda that has been dragging on for years, only 2 residents remain. Retired safety inspector turned beekeeper Sergei Sergeyevich and Pashka, a frenemy from his school days. With little food and no electricity under ever-present threat of bombardment, Sergeyevich's 1 remaining pleasure is his bees. As spring approaches, he knows he must take them far from the grey zone so that they can collect their pollen in peace. This simple mission on their behalf introduces him to combatants and civilians on both sides of the battle lines, loyalists, separatists, Russian occupiers, and Crimean Tartars. Wherever he goes, Sergeyevich's childlike simplicity and strong moral compass disarm everyone he meets. But could these be qualities that are manipulated to serve an unworthy cause, spelling disaster for him, his bees, and his country? Grey Bees is as timely as the author's Ukrainian diaries were in 2014, but treats the unfolding crisis in a more imaginative way, with a pinch of Kirkov's signature humour. Who better than Ukraine's most famous novelist, who writes in Russian, to illuminate and present a balanced portrait of this most bewildering of modern conflicts.
"Fools can't get to sleep," Sergeyevich said to himself, probably just warming their hands. Then he returned to the dark interior of the house and lit a candle. Its warm, pleasant, honeyed scent hit his nose, and his ears were soothed by the familiar, quiet ticking of the alarm clock on the narrow wooden windowsill. There was still a hint of heat inside the stove's belly, but not enough to get the frosty coal going without the help of wood chips and paper. Eventually, when the long bluish tongues of flame began to lick at the smoke-stained glass, the master of the house stepped out into the yard again. The sound of distant bombardment, almost inaudible inside the house, now reached Sergeyevich's ears from the east. But soon another sound drew his attention. He heard a car driving nearby. Then it stopped. There were only 2 proper streets in the village, one named after Lenin, the other after Taras Shevchenko, and also Ivan Michurin Lane. Sergeyevich himself lived on Lenin, in less than proud isolation. This meant that the car had been driving down Shevchenko. There, too, only 1 person was left, Pasha Khmelenko, who, like Sergeyevich, had retired early. The 2 men were almost exactly the same age and had been enemies from their first days at school. Pashka's garden looked out towards Gorlivka, so he was one street closer to Donetsk than Sergeyevich. Sergeyevich's garden faced in the other direction, towards Slavyansk. It sloped down to a field which first dipped, then rose up towards Zhdanivka. You couldn't actually see Zhdanivka from the garden. It lay hidden behind a hump. But you could sometimes hear the Ukrainian army, which had burrowed dugouts and trenches into the hump. And even when he couldn't hear the army, Sergeyevich was always aware of its presence. It sat in its dugouts and trenches, to the left of the forest plantation and the dirt road along which tractors and lorries used to drive.
Andrei Kurkov's Grey Bees is narrated by Andrew Byron and runs for 11 hours, 54 minutes.
A new look at the science of World War II is The Battle of the Beams, the secret science of radar that turned the tide of World War II by Tom Whipple, which was donated to us by Penguin Random House.
One evening in early November 1939, a German businessman made a request of the head porter at the Hotel Bristol in Oslo. "Would it be possible," he asked, "to borrow a typewriter?" Hans Ferdinand Mayer was a middle-aged man with neat, swept-back hair and the sort of boringly technical job that rarely invited further questions. As he took the machine up to his room on that cold Norwegian night, it seems unlikely anyone would have looked up from their drinks to watch a man in a generic suit heading upstairs. The chances are, in fact, that no one who saw him that day ever learned that they had been witness to one of the greatest intelligence leaks in history.
Summer 1939. War is coming. The British believe that, through ingenuity and scientific prowess, they alone have a war-winning weapon, radar. They are wrong. The Germans have it too. They believe that their unique maritime history means their pilots have no need of navigational aids. Flying above the clouds, they, like the seafarers of old, had the stars to guide them, and that is all that is required. They're wrong. Most of the bombs the RAF will drop in the first years of the war land miles from their target. They also believe that the Germans, without the same naval tradition, will never be able to find targets at night. They are, again, wrong. In 1939, the Germans don't just have radar to spot planes entering their airspace. They have radio beams to guide their own planes into enemy airspace. War is coming, and it is to be a different kind of war. It will be fought, as expected, on land and sea and in the air. It will also be fought on the airwaves. It will be fought between scientists on both sides at the forefront of knowledge and the agents and commandos they relied on to bolster that knowledge. Luckily, there was one young engineer, Reginald Jones, helping the British government with their own scientific developments. In June 1940, when Jones quietly explained the beams the Germans had devised to a room full of disbelieving sceptics, Churchill later described the moment as like sitting in the parlour while Sherlock Holmes finally reveals the killer. Churchill immediately supported Jones's efforts to develop radar technology that went on to help the Allies win the war. Relying on first-hand accounts from Reginald Jones, as well as papers recently released by the Admiralty, the Battle of the Beams fills a huge missing piece in the canon of World War II literature. It is a tale that combines history, science, daring do and dogged determination, and will appeal as much to fans of World War II history as to those fascinated by the science behind the beams that changed our lives. The Radio War of 1939-45 is one of the great scientific battles in history. This is the story of that war.
Mayer was a brilliant scientist who had become part of the German corporate machinery. He had studied under a Nobel laureate, published papers and patents, then risen through the ranks to head up the Siemens Research Laboratory in Berlin. Here, during the 1930s, his job had changed, subtly at first. Increasingly, his role was not civil, but military, and especially, he wrote, he found himself working on new and secret weapons, which required communications and electronics techniques. He understood all too well the significance. This meant, he wrote, sooner or later, war. This worried him greatly. Mayer did not like the Nazis. He loathed them, in fact. He could not understand why his colleagues joined the Nazi party. Hitler had proclaimed the Germans to be the master race, superior to all other nations, which should work for them as slaves, he said. He had also deprived the Jews of their citizenship, confining them to the status of subjects. It was not merely that this was, to him, abhorrent. Perhaps he could forgive his Nazi colleagues if they were merely evil. To his rational, scientific mind, it was something else too, something far less understandable. It was, he said, such nonsense.
The Battle of the Beams, The Secret Science of Radar That Turned the Tide of World War II, by Tobe Whipple, is read by the author, and runs for 9 hours, 9 minutes.
Our readers enjoyed Lady in Waiting by Anne Glyn-Connor so much that they requested her follow-up, Whatever Next, which was kindly donated to us by Hodder.
Sometimes I wonder if I might have had a career as an actress as a child. I've always loved putting on shows and dressing up. My husband, Colin, and Princess Margaret were both marvellous performers, and I think in another life Colin would have made an excellent theatrical producer. But when they put on plays at our house in Scotland during our summers, I was always too busy to appear. My role as a wife and as a lady-in-waiting was to support them in all their performances, public and private, and it was one I played willingly. Then almost 20 years after the death of Princess Margaret, and 10 years after Collins, I unexpectedly had the chance to gallop onto the stage. It was over lunch with friends in Norfolk that this fresh chapter of my life began.
Anne Glyn-Connor's glittering life hasn't always been golden. As she revealed in her astonishing best-selling memoir, Lady-in-Waiting, it has been one of stark contrasts. From growing up in the splendour of Holkham Hall to living in a tent in the jungle of Mystique, from travelling the world with Princess Margaret to coping with her wildly unpredictable husband, Lord Glyn-Connor. Tragically, she's also survived the loss of two of her sons and nursed a third son back from a coma. Now in her 90th year and at her happiest, Anne brings her bracing honesty, characteristic wit and courage to reflect on and reveal more about her long and unexpected life, her extremely volatile marriage, and what it taught her. As a wife, she became a master in the art of keeping the peace, knowing when to pick her battles and when she needed help, and when to take a lover. As a hostess, she acquired great practical skills in throwing marvellous parties and looking after magnificent homes, and as a lady-in-waiting, became well-versed in diplomacy and etiquette. It was as a mother she learnt the toughest lessons of all, and through them the value of friendship, family and laughter to get her through the worst moments in life, as well as celebrate the best of them. Anne Glyn-Connor's Whatever Next is the richly entertaining proof that staying open to every new adventure and being ready for whatever happens sets an inspiring example for us all.
It's a lovely day. We were eating outside in the sunshine, and I was telling some of my stories. I was a little more fired up than usual, as a biography of Princess Margaret had recently been published that I felt was terribly unfair to her. One of my fellow guests was the publisher, Tom Perrin. After listening to me for a while, Tom asked me if I've ever thought of writing a book. I've always been an avid reader, but my own book didn't sound a likely idea at all. I wasn't sure anybody would be interested. Tom kept encouraging me, and eventually he introduced me to his colleague Rowena Webb and the team at Hodder and Stoughton. The next thing I knew, I was being ushered into their rather grand offices overlooking the Thames and sharing my stories with them. Strictly speaking, this was not my first venture into publishing. In 1983, my friend Susanna, I called her Zanna Johnson, and I published a collection of recipes and reminiscences about outdoor eating called The Picnic Papers. We both were keen fans of picnics, so we thought the book might be a rather fun way to raise money in aid of a charity for children with cerebral palsy, of which I was president at the time. I was looking at a copy recently, and I think it stands up rather well. We asked friends and family to write something for us about picnics, ideally with recipes, and ended up with quite a range of anecdotes and reminiscences. My mother, aunt and sister wrote about traditional English picnics, and my mother also described velvet, the thick layer of skin shed from the antlers of the deer in Holcombe Park, which was collected, fried and served on toast as a delicacy. There were fun contributions too from Diana Cooper, Harold Acton and John Julius Norwich, but the best was Princess Margaret's. She wrote that her favourite kind of picnic was a cold collation eaten while sitting at a table with chairs, china and cutlery, and preferably inside to be sure of good weather. She also suggested bringing one's butler to make sure everything went smoothly. It was all very deadpan, and I'm certain most people didn't guess she was joking. I think the book sold respectably well, but it certainly didn't break any records. I enjoyed the whole process very much, especially taking some of the photographs, but assumed the picnic papers would be the beginning and end of my publishing career, until my meeting with the team at Hodder.
Whatever Next, Lessons from an Unexpected Life by Anne Glenconner, is read by Anne Glenconner and lasts for 6 hours 53 minutes.
And finally, Stacey Abrams was not only a US politician and voting rights activist, but is also now an author. Her second book, Rogue Justice, was given to us by HarperCollins.
Avery Keene took the assigned seat. Her massive black hair with its tight curls tamed into a sleek chignon at her nape. The hunter green suit she'd chosen for today's inquisition complemented her caramel skin and clear green eyes. For jewelry, she wore department store pearls and a slim gold watch that had once belonged to her maternal grandmother, a woman she'd never met. The circa 1920s piece kept excellent time, and the links were made of real gold. Her mother, Rita, had pawned it years ago. 14-year-old Avery secretly bought it back with a sob story and $158 she had squirreled away from completing homework for overprivileged, lazy kids. She drew the line at cheat sheets and crib notes. Homework was for practice, and if they wanted to squander a chance at learning, that was on them.
Supreme Court clerk Avery Keene is back, trying to get her feet on solid ground after unravelling an international conspiracy in While Justice Sleeps. But as the sparks of congressional hearings and political skirmishes swirl around her, Avery is approached at a legal conference by Preston Davis, an unassuming young man and fellow law clerk to a federal judge in Idaho. Davis believes his boss, Judge Francesca Whitner, was being blackmailed in the days before she died. Desperate to understand what happened, he gives Avery a file, a burner phone, and a fearful warning that there are highly dangerous people involved. Another shocking murder leads Avery to a list of names, all federal judges, and alarmingly, all judges on the FISA court, also known as America's Secret Court. It is this body that grants permission to the government to wiretap Americans or spy on corporations suspected of terrorism. As Avery digs deeper, she begins to see a frightening pattern, and she worries that something far more sinister may be unfolding inside the nation's third branch of government. With lives at stake, Avery must race the clock and an unexpected enemy to find the answer.
By then, she'd built a nest egg of $1,792, and only sentiment forced her to part with even a penny. Lucky for her, the pawn dealer hadn't realized Rita was telling the truth about the watch's value, which meant she got it back for a fraction of its worth. After recovering the watch, Avery had stashed it with her emergency money and the precious few treasures she still had from her father, like the engraved knife she'd consciously left at home. On days like this, and nearly every day, she sincerely wished she still had him too. Arthur Keene had perished in a bus accident weeks after her 9th birthday, leaving her with a broken mother who'd crawled into alcohol, drugs, and destitution. Avery had decided that night at the pawn shop that she would never follow her mother's spiral down. She hadn't gone down, but her life had certainly spun sideways. Avery shifted in her seat, waiting for the proceedings to begin. She unfolded her copy of the New York Times and let her eyes scan down the front page article that catalogued the current woes of the nation and her own existence.
Rogue Justice by Stacey Abrams is read by Aden Relay Ojo and runs for 12 hours 33 minutes.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
My love of reading is very great, and the pleasure I have derived from books is very great.
Author, actor and creator of Downton Abbey, Julian Fellowes, on why he supports Talking Books.
This whole business of Talking Books matters to me. Reading is everything. You know, when you're blind, reading is travel. Reading is the last way that you can still enjoy certain things that are no longer realistic for a blind person to enjoy autonomously. It is an absolute lifeline, and we can help them keep that lifeline going.
For more information on the Talking Book service and how to support it, head to rnib.org.uk. Now a return to the author of Art Is Everywhere, Joe Haddo, for the books of his life. Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Yes. And I might be cheeky here and try and use this question to bring in a whole series of books, if I'm allowed. The book I'm thinking of specifically is called The Bellmaker, and it's by Brian Jacks. Or Jakes, I never know. I sort of said Jakes, but I think it's Jacks. Anyway, he's no longer with us, but he wrote a series called Red Wall. And when I was 10, there was a poster of The Bellmaker, which is, I think, his third or fourth book in this series, up on the wall of my school classroom. And I saw it every day, and it intrigued me every day, to the point where my teacher at the time, Mr. Simmons, said, well, you know, you could read it. And I thought, oh, yeah, well, I could read it. Because up until that point, yes, I'd read books, but mainly graphic novels and comics, actually, and never really picked up a book of my own for pleasure, I don't think. Whereas this was it. And I remember telling my parents about it, and they said, well, we can go to the bookshop and we can get you it if you like. And I thought, well, yeah. So down we went to the local bookstore in Eastbourne, and they bought me The Bellmaker by Brian Jacks, and I was absolutely transported because it's fantasy fiction. It's about animals that talk, and it's about animal warriors. And the lead character in The Bellmaker is called Joseph the Bellmaker. So I instantly connected with him because he's got the same name as me. And it's just a fabulous, fabulous book of good and evil and war and fighting and friendship and food and feasting. And it's just a lovely, lovely book. And I then went back to the start of the series to a book called Martin the Warrior, which I think is the first one in the whole Red Bull series. And then I was just hooked, and I read every single one. And very recently got given back my whole collection by my parents who were going through the loft, and they found a box with all of them in. So I've got all of them upstairs, so I might even read them again.
It is said that in the hungry land of ice and snow from whence he came, the beast was known and feared by the names he had taken. Foxwolf, the Urgan na Gru. He and his mate Silvermord commanded a vast horde of savage grey rats. They ravaged the Northlands unopposed. Tundra, forest and mountain lay under the claws of na Gru and his vixen. But the Foxwolf knew there was one enemy he could never defeat, one foe more ruthless than any living thing. Winter. Snow, ice, howling blizzards and famine were the real rulers of the country he had despoiled. A bone-chilling starkness that conquered all. Na Gru and Silvermord were forced to yield, realizing that starvation and death stalked the country they had stripped bare. So it was that Na Gru took Silvermord and all the hoard in three great ships to search for the sun. Those were the dangerous seasons. Battered across dark, roaring seas they went, narrowly dodging huge floating ice mountains, the ship's sails and riggings frozen stiff with rimy spray. Sometimes they lay becalmed in ghostly latitudes, wreathed in spectral mists, with the waters beneath them still and fathomless. Completely lost, the Foxwolf ploughed onwards, driven across trackless wastes where no vessel's bow had ever cut spray, avoiding leviathans of the deep and shoals of unnamed sea-beasts. Strange, hostile waters closed over their wake as the weary convoy sailed deeper into the unknown.
Jonathan Oliver reading from The Bellmaker, Book 7 in the Redwall series by Brian Jacks. Available from RNIB Talking Books, as are all of the Redwall series. Is there a book on a rainy day you go back to again and again to reread?
There's an author I go back to again and again on a rainy day. His name is Raymond Chandler, and the book I probably go back to again and again and again on a rainy day is The Long Goodbye. Published in, I believe, 1953, I think. And it's one of his Philip Marlowe novels, who's a PI, set in Los Angeles. And I've got a soft spot for Los Angeles. I've got a soft spot for the hard-boiled crime. And I just love curling up and reading a Raymond Chandler novel if the weather's awful outside and it's cold and it's tipping it down, because there's a darkness to the books. There's a sort of noiriness to them anyway, which suits the weather, but they're set in Los Angeles, so ultimately they are in very nice weather. So you can be transported away from said rainy day into the bright sunshine of Los Angeles. And I just think his Philip Marlowe novels are fantastic. They're super easy to read. They're full of what we'd now call cliches, but he was one of the first people doing them, so they're only cliches because people have copied him. There's a murder, there's a missing body, there's two families who are sort of entwined in this murder. There's nothing is as it seems. I just absolutely love it. The Long Goodbye.
The first time I laid eyes on Terry Lennox, he was drunk in a Rolls-Royce Silver Wraith outside the terrace of the dancers. The parking lot attendant had brought the car out, and he was still holding the door open because Terry Lennox's left foot was still dangling outside, as if he had forgotten he had one. He had a young-looking face, but his hair was bone white. You could tell by his eyes that he was plastered to the hairline, but otherwise he looked like any other nice young guy in a dinner jacket who had been spending too much money in a joint that exists for that purpose and for no other. There was a girl beside him. Her hair was a lovely shade of dark red, and she had a distant smile on her lips. And over her shoulder she had a blue mink that almost made the Rolls-Royce look like just another automobile. It didn't quite. Nothing can. The attendant was the usual half-tough character in a white coat, with the name of the restaurant stitched across the front of it in red. He was getting fed up. Look, mister, he said with an edge to his voice. Would you mind a whole lot pulling your leg into the car so I can kind of shut the door? Or should I open it all the way so you can fall out? The girl gave him a look which ought to have stuck at least 4 inches out of his back. It didn't bother him enough to give him the shakes. At the dancers, they get the sort of people that disillusion you about what a lot of golfing money can do for the personality. A low-swung foreign speedster with no top drifted into the parking lot, and a man got out of it and used the dash lighter on a long cigarette. He was wearing a pullover check shirt, yellow slacks, and riding boots. He strolled off, trailing clouds of incense, and not even bothering to look towards the Rolls-Royce. He probably thought it was corny. At the foot of the steps up to the terrace, he paused to stick a monocle in his eye. The girl said with a nice burst of charm, "I have a wonderful idea, darling. Why don't we just take the cab to your place and get your convertible out? It's such a wonderful night for a run up to the coast, to Montecito. I know some people up there who are throwing a dance around the pool." The white-haired lad said politely, "Awfully sorry, but I don't have it anymore. I was compelled to sell it." From his voice and articulation, you wouldn't have known he had anything stronger than orange juice to drink. "Sold it, darling? How do you mean?" She slid away from him along the seat, but her voice slid a lot farther than that. "I mean, I had to," he said, "for eating money." "Oh, I see."
That's David Bauer reading from The Long Goodbye, one of many Raymond Chandler books in the RNIB Talking Books Library. And is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to recommend?
I read a lot, Robert, as I'm sure you do, and I'm constantly trying to remember what I read last or recently and that I enjoyed. And I've started, because I'm so bad at it, keeping a list, so that when people like yourself ask me that question, I go, "Oh, yes, I think I know." Because I run the Radio 2 Book Club, we're reading a lot of contemporary commercial fiction for that. And there's been some absolutely brilliant, brilliant choices recently that Zoe has featured on her show. One book that I have read and loved is by Brandon Taylor, and it's called The Late Americans. It's his third book. It's his second novel, I think, because the second book he published was short stories. Brandon Taylor's first book was called Real Life, and it was shortlisted for the Booker Prize. This is a sort of a continuation of that. It's called The Late Americans. It's set in Iowa City, and it's just an incredible piece of literature, in my opinion, from a brilliant young writer. So it's got a huge cast of characters, and not about one person. It's about a group of academics, and it's loosely set in a campus, you know, a university campus. So it's if you were trying to class it, it would be classed as a campus novel. And it's got poets and students and landlords and artists and people who work in the meatpacking district and mathematicians and thinkers. And every chapter follows on from another person. So it's a bit like a relay race. The character in the chapter before almost hands the book over to the next character. And it's just a wonderful piece of writing. And I read it a few weeks ago, and he came on Book Off, my podcast. And not only is he a brilliant writer, but he's a lovely person too.
Beth's lips were a thin line, her eyebrows in deep grooves. Miserable despite the praise, when praise seemed so much the point of the poems they wrote. To be clapped on the back, celebrated, turned into modern saints and martyrs. Curiouser and curiouser, thought Seamus, that a person presented with what they wanted most could seem so miserable about it. Along the upper wall of the seminar room, trapezoidal panes of glass. The room was all sleek, dark wood beams and soaring windows, barn-like in its effect. Early afternoon sunshine pooling on the scuffed floors. Locked cases of books by writing program alumni who had gone on to mid-list glory. The patina of prestige, so much like the corroded wax on the floorboards, had seen better days. That was the thing about prestige, though. The older and more moth-eaten, the more valuable. There was a certain kind of poet for whom prestige was the point. The poetry was the prestige, and if no one saw you writing a poem, being a poet, then you were not a poet. For these poets, seminar was the zenith of their lives as artists. Never again would they have, on a weekly basis, such attention channeled upon their performance of poetry. This poem really troubles notions of reliability, because, like, who is more an authority on an experience than the person doing the experiencing, right? But, like, the inconsistencies in the telling really make you wonder if the truth is really a palimpsest of falsehoods. And Helen again, though now interrupted by Garza, half Tunisian, half Quebecois, but raised in Toronto and Oakland. Totally. In this very Vicuña way, like in Spit Temple, I prefer Moraga's take on personal history and how we bridge gaps in the archive with Noreen, West Virginian with a faint lilt that might have been faked. It was curiously absent when she was drunk, cutting across Garza's response. Hartman tells us that archives are constructed in the manner of Noli, cutting in too. These sundry interruptions and redactions, all the skirmishes and misdirection, like a dog finally catching its tail and chewing it down to the gristle. Seamus looked to his right at Oliver, who was listening intently with a pleased, receptive expression. How, Seamus wondered, could he take this all so seriously?
That's Kevin R. Free reading from The Late Americans by Brandon Taylor, which is available commercially. Real Life by Brandon Taylor is available in audio and braille from the RNIB Talking Books Library. And once again, Joe Harrell, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for talking to me.
That's all we've got time for on today's show, but remember, this show is also available as a podcast. There are over 300 episodes in your favourite podcast app. Just search for RNIB Read On. I'll be back at the same time next week. But remember, our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB Library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 7 a.m. with a different tale at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.